Welcome to DACOM Digital, the Digital Asset Compliance and Market Integrity Podcast. Solidus Labs hosts conversations with the builders, movers, and shakers of a safe and regulated crypto and DeFi industry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to DACOM Digital, where we speak with the builders, movers, and shakers of a safe and regulated crypto industry. And today, we have a really great opportunity to speak with an enormous expert on various elements of crypto risk and compliance and legal. And it's my personal pleasure, specifically because I think it's fair to say, Andrew, that we're friends. Andrew Jacobson is with us here, VP and Global Head of Legal at 21 Shares, 21 Co., one of the leading crypto-native ETF and ETP issuers, doing really, really interesting stuff. And also, I won't bury the headline. I'll start with that. If I understand correctly, Andrew, you're filing for a rule change application that would allow Spot Bitcoin ETF is currently first in line to be reviewed and either approved or rejected by the SEC. Correct? Incorrect?
That's exactly right. We have about a 2+ month lead from our competitors.
That's not a bad lead by any means. So in that sense, also very, very timely for this topic a topic that has fascinated me, the rejection of Bitcoin Spot ETF applications in the US since the day I joined crypto. And obviously has recently made a lot of headlines following the BlackRock's application. We'll get into that. But I do want to thank you for being with us, Andrew. And if you don't, I do want to say, so just for a little bit of context, you and I originally got to connect. The first time we met was actually because we were on the same team on the New York Department of Financial Services' tech sprint, which was focused on basically bringing people from all walks of the crypto industry together with regulators to try and suggest ways to regulate crypto in better ways through technology. So that was a wild experience, wasn't it?
it was. Not only were we on the same team, our team won. And it was the first time that the New York DFS did a tech sprint with the industry. And so it was a great, really great experience. And maybe 4 or 5 years ago now, which is crazy.
Yeah. Maybe in crypto years.
Maybe crypto years.
March 2021.
Maybe you're right.
Quite a while ago. I remember it was peak of COVID. I was chain smoking cigarettes doing all the meetings.
Crypto years are like dog years. Every year is like 7 years in reality.
Yes, exactly. It's pretty wild. Anyway, but it was a really cool experience. And we did win. We created a cool dashboard that I think would still be very, very helpful for any regulator that wants to try and understand the industry better. I know that, they still have it at DFS. So who knows, maybe one day it will turn real. But it also was, I think, now factually, we can say the beginning of a beautiful friendship. Really great to have you here, Andrew. At the time, you were working for a law firm. And, we'll get into that a little bit. Since then, you've moved and became fully crypto native. So let me start, instead of me, following my tendency to try and provide all the information, let me just ask you to tell us a little bit about yourself. You are a former regulator as well. You did work for DFS. We'd love to hear about that. And tell us about your journey becoming, turning from a crypto lawyer heavyweight specialized in sanctions, to becoming a 21 Shares GC. So what brought you here?
Yeah, thank you, Chen, for having me on this podcast. Really a big fan of the work that you guys are doing in this space, and you've been doing it from the beginning. So really, really a pleasure to chat. I started my career in government. I started as an enforcement attorney at the New York DFS, really when the department was created. And so I started summer of 2012. The DFS was under a year old at the time. And it was before DFS, there was the old New York State Banking Department and the old New York State Insurance Department, neither of which would have had much jurisdiction over crypto. Both those departments were merged. They created a whole new enforcement arm, a whole new set of powers. And that's where I started. I started doing financial fraud investigations. I worked on, some of the biggest investigations into foreign exchange manipulation. And so we brought all the big FX market manipulation cases around the cartels, around the use of automated trading functions to essentially front run customers. I also helped lead some of the biggest sanctions and AML cases at the time that DFS really helped pioneer, and really was leading, DOJ, OFAC, Federal Reserve, and others. I spent about 4 years at the DFS. I then went into private practice where I started really helping build out their crypto practice. I did other stuff. I did litigation work, enforcement work, but I was really helping build out their crypto practice. And that's really how you and I met, through the New York DFS's tech sprint. I was asked to join and serve, as I'm sure you were as well. I was in private practice at a law firm doing my thing for about 7 years. I did not expect to leave working in a law firm. I was connected to 21 Shares because they were looking for a head of legal for their US operations. I loved working in a law firm. The challenge is when you're at a law firm in crypto, people only come to you when there's a problem. You don't get to work on issues from the beginning, on products from the beginning. And that really was, convinced me to take the leap. I knew that if I stayed at a law firm, I would do crypto work for the rest of my life, but I would do it only in really crisis type situations, not at the early stages, and said, you know what? I can't pass up this opportunity. So, 21 Shares founders, the top leadership team really convinced me that this would be a good move. And I joined our company about a year, 14 months ago to oversee legal globally now, as well as compliance, risk, and regulatory affairs.
It's unbelievable. It's already been 14 months. Sorry, I really remember when you made the move. And it's such an interesting point you raise. I never really thought about it, but the limitations I get, the one limitation of working on a law firm, you get to work on a lot of different diverse cases, a lot of different clients. But at the end of the day, there's something that is inherently reactive to it.
Yeah.
Really interesting point. I never thought about it that way. I think, I say it almost every podcast episode, so I'll say it again. I just am a really firm believer that at this point in the crypto and DeFi industry's evolution, I genuinely believe that its future and the fulfillment of the potential of all of this depends as much on legal entrepreneurs and innovators as it does on technical entrepreneurs and innovators. And in my book, you're definitely one of those. So the more the merrier of folks like you coming to the industry.
I appreciate you saying that, and I would say this. I mean, to be in the industry, it's different. When you're, like I said, when you're at a law firm, you give advice and then you move on to a different client. At my company, the buck stops with me. I'm responsible. If we make a mistake, it's on me. If we do something right, I get the benefit, you name it. And so, to be really a crypto lawyer, I think you have to be, you kind of have to have your full, you have to be in it fully. And I think that was harder to do at a law firm than it was in-house, I think.
Again, a really interesting perspective, and I hope that it would inspire many others to, go through the journey that you did and join the industry. Because again, we need folks like you. So let's jump a little bit into 21 Shares. I don't think I'm familiar with a lot of fully crypto native ETP issuers. It's really a field where a lot of the big actors are ultimately. They ultimately come from, traditional finance, because ETFs and ETPs are a traditional financial instrument. So it's a really cool concept. It's important to say that it's a firm that's, I think, is based in Europe. Correct me if I'm wrong, with a large US operation. So you also have that kind of dual perspective. So let me ask you, can you dive a little deeper into what is 21 Shares' role in the industry? What are you guys doing to bridge TradFi and crypto through those innovative investment products? And also, what are you doing to enable just generally safe and regulated crypto trading?
It's a really good question. We have offices in Zurich in Switzerland, London and New York. And we've got, I'd say, probably half the company in Zurich and London, then, Zurich and New York, smaller percentage in London. But, I view our company as a tech company that happens to also be an asset manager. Our 5-year anniversary will be this November. We were the first to issue an ETP that was backed, physically backed by crypto. I think the reason we got into the crypto ETP space was not because we were a traditional asset manager looking for additional alpha. Really what it was is that we were a crypto company looking to make it easier to access crypto as an asset class. And so I view half the company as an asset manager, a purely crypto asset manager. We're not doing anything else from a traditional financial services perspective. We are crypto native. The other half of our company is a tech company. We've got a big engineering team. We've got product managers. We've got, you know, a whole host of support staff that you'd typically see at a tech company like an Amazon, Netflix, Facebook, you name it. That's really how we're structured. And so, you know, what is 21 Shares? 21 Shares, technically, legally speaking, is the issuer of our ETPs. We also have 21 Co, which is the brand for, you know, our tech business. And so, you know, I think the values that we like to promote are really making crypto easily accessible, but also safe. I mean, you talk about ETPs, and we were joking before this call that I joke that it's really a boring topic, and it's boring, you know, for a reason. You know, ETPs are a very safe, regulated, reliable way to access crypto, and to us, you know, we think it should be boring because we think it's something that people really shouldn't have to worry about. You and I might get excited about it, but ultimately, it's a very simple structure, and that's really the big value that we promote.
You know, I think there's so much insight in what you just said. Well, let me kind of briefly reiterate some of the main insights I got out of this. So first of all, there's always this question of, you know, the pure crypto play versus the companies coming with traditional knowledge, et cetera. Although it's important to say that today, most crypto plays also have a lot of expertise and people who come from the traditional world. But, you know, I can very much relate to this. Crypto Solidus Labs is a fully crypto native company. We will rise and fall with this industry. That's our mission, to make it work. And every time I see a big traditional legacy firm doing anything in crypto, and then a few months afterwards, when there's a bear market, or I don't know, there wasn't enough revenue, taking a step back, you know, it frustrates me. But obviously there's also an important role for those sort of firms. But anyway, it's always, I get excited about pure crypto plays. And I think that doing pure crypto play in a sort of conservative field like ETPs, like you're describing, is really important. The industry, we tend to sensationalize everything. We tend to there's a lot of, crypto is really exciting, but in practice, most people, when they're thinking about finance, they're looking for stable things. So it's a really good point. So in that sense, I asked you, what is the role you guys are playing? I think you answered it splendidly. It's a very important role.
We're the market share leader in Europe. We're the first, exactly, in the ETP space. We're the leader in Europe. We're the first to have done it. We have the largest product suite of crypto-backed ETPs in the world. And we're doing a lot in Europe. We're doing Asia, you know, we're doing some stuff in parts of Asia. We're doing some stuff in the Middle East. We're launching stuff in the US. And so, you know, I think that when I think about our company in particular, we're really blending technical expertise with, you know, asset management, you know, skills.
I mean, that's awesome. And again, I would recommend to anyone, listening to really check out 21 Shares. We had an opportunity to host Ophelia, your CEO, Ophelia Snyder, at our DACOM event that we hosted in, I think it was December 2021. It was the same one where Gary Gensler spoke. So, you know, it was a hit. It was in the New York Times, and she did an amazing job. So also a very inspiring leader that your firm has. I feel briefly a need to explain my background. I'm speaking from Hong Kong. and this is just the background in my hotel room. Lots of interesting stuff happening here, but that's for another podcast episode. And also, we will be talking about investment products. Nothing here is an investment advice. And, I'll also say for Andrew that nothing here is legal advice as well.
Exactly. And I should note, these are my personal views, not the views of our company or any of our affiliates, but I'm not too worried about it. We'll keep it tame.
We'll keep it tame. We'll do our best. So we will be spending most of the time talking about ETFs. But before that, there's a question that I ask everyone who comes on this show. And obviously, as a GC, you play an important role in strategy. It's like literally part of the definition of the role, like how legal advises strategy. So let me ask you a little bit, for a firm like 21 Shares and the kind of products that you're working on, what is the role that you know, I'll ask you about legal, although if you want to kind of weave in compliance as well, that would be, you know, also interesting. But what is the role that legal and compliance play within business strategy? And also, how has it evolved, you know, since you joined, you know, and in the past kind of crazy year in crypto? Curious if you have any thoughts on that.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I would say legal and compliance are fundamental to anything that the business does. And that's, you know, one of our duties as a company that's subject to many regulations. And so anytime we're coming up with new product ideas, anytime we're helping market our products, anytime we're, you know, engaged in various operational activities, legal is fundamental to that. And so I view the role of our legal and compliance group as really twofold. One, it's to be a partner to the business. And so we are fundamental and you know, essential to execution of new products, of new ventures, you name it. And the second is we are really the last line of defense, really the protector of the company. And so, you know, I think one of the real cultural shifts that I tried to impart when I joined the company was that legal was going to be there at the beginning. Product team has new idea, brainstorming sessions, we're in the room. When we're coming up with, you know, PRDs, we're in the PRD coming up, vetting new ideas early to avoid blockers. And so I think historically legal at many companies is viewed as a blocker, as viewed as somebody that constantly is saying no. We do say no a lot of times, but we help try to find solutions. And so we'll never say you can't do it without giving some solution on how you can do it. I think another interesting thing is that I sit with the business team. Our legal team sits with the business team. I did not want legal to be separate on a different floor in a different part of the room. We sit with the product teams. We sit with the engineers. I look at them all day. It makes my life a little bit more difficult because they're always coming up to me all day. But you know what? I think the important thing is that a legal department cannot hide from the business. If legal is separate from the business, that gives them more incentive to ignore issues, to say no, do whatever, not work with them. And so I really wanted to set the tone that we are in the trenches with you. We're working with you. We're a partner, not an adversary. So that's really how I view legal and compliance philosophically at our company.
I think, you know, we'll end the episode with, you know, I'll ask you for some best practices, but I think you just gave a really, really interesting one. And I think it's true. It's definitely true for legal, this idea of like not kind of sitting on a legal ivory tower and you know, putting down, verdicts or whatever you want to call it that kind of stop things, but really being a part of the team. But I think it's true for any element almost in a company. And you know, kind of the better leaders within those departments understand it, the better in our experience, at least at Solidus Labs. So really, really important point. To your point about, I'll go back to another cliche that I think I repeat in a lot of episodes, but to your point about like, generally, there's a tendency in, I would say, in the financial world, and even more so in the crypto world, specifically in crypto native companies, sometimes to look at legal, to look at compliance as a blocker and as something that, you know, you just kind of need to try and avoid. But the way I always think about it is how fast a car can go depends as much on the brakes as it does on the engine.
Yeah.
Because none of us would press the gas pedal if we don't know that we can stop immediately if we press the brakes.
And the steering wheel in many ways, right? Just so it's not always stopping, it's swerving, you know, adjusting your route, you know, to ultimately achieve success.
So true. So you know, none of us would do it. And you simply can't go fast without it. You can go fast and think you're fine, but you're not, is the bottom line. And there's, at this point, too many examples of where, you know, those functions weren't effective in providing those breaks. So I hope that if anyone ever complains to you about it, my cliche would be helpful.
Nobody complains. You know what? I think one of the big aspects of our company that I really, it really comes down to our founders and our leadership team is really promoting culture of compliance. And that's really comes from the top. And, you know, we are constantly pushing that to every employee at the company. And they know that our management, our founders believe in it. They agree with it. You know, we're a company that operates within regulatory frameworks. And so our success is really tied to that. And I think a good, you know, you talk about like, we'll talk best practices, but I think one thing that we do is that we give pretty extensive trainings to our whole business side. And so anytime anybody joins our company, they meet with me. I meet with every single person that joins our company and give them really a sense of compliance do's and don'ts and all that kind of stuff. So we really build it in. We ingrain it in our employees, and you know, we really don't have the degree of pushback that maybe you would see at shops that don't really care about that kind of stuff.
I think that's the right culture to have for any crypto firm. And you know, you say you're operating within a regulated environment. The reality is that there almost isn't any company in the world that doesn't operate within some regulatory environment, even if they think they don't. So I would advise everyone to listen to that advice. And again, I'm advising this, but it's not legal advice. It's personal advice. So let's dive into it. ETFs. It's really, to me, you know, although it's in the headlines so often, you know, I think I've read most of the application filings and rejection documents over the past 5-6 years. And you know, it's in the headlines so often. The industry is so excited about it. And yet, I think the actual conversation, the actual coverage, the actual debate, it rarely goes past the headlines. So we have a real opportunity here to dive in with someone who provides the legal counsel for putting some of these products into applications that would hopefully one day hit the market. And I'm really excited to have this conversation. So as I mentioned, just to iterate again, you said that 21 Shares is first in line, yeah, in a filing through SIBO. I didn't realize, but you have essentially a 2 months, foreigner moment. I can't think of the right word, but you know what I mean.
We have a 2 month lead in which the SEC, yes, should have been reviewing our 19, yes, or not our 19 before, SIBO's 19 before.
Right. So let's start with back to basics for a little bit. What is an ETF, a Bitcoin ETF application?
It's a really good question. Well, what is a Bitcoin ETF? A Bitcoin ETF is really it's a security that incorporates Bitcoin physically. So it's an ETF wrapper that holds Bitcoin, and investors can benefit from the ups and downs of Bitcoin price fluctuation. And so it's physically backed. It's not a synthetic product. Let's go to what's the application. In the United States, in order to offer securities to investors, you have to register those securities with the SEC unless you're relying on an exemption. For an ETF, what you'd have to do is essentially get SEC approval to offer shares in your ETF, which is a security, and then you need SEC approval to list those shares on an exchange. And that's how SIBO comes into play here. And so, you know, what we are seeking approval for is to, you know, essentially register the shares of our ETF with the SEC, as well as list those shares on SIBO pursuant to the securities laws. What that means is that the SEC has to review SIBO's rule change, which is a 19b-4 application. They also eventually will review our prospectus, which is our S1, which we filed. And from there, hopefully we'll approve it. But that's really what it is at its basic. And for other industries, it's typically not an issue, listing and registering shares of securities. But for crypto, obviously, there's been additional considerations that have come up.
Right. And you know what? I have a very simple mind. I'm going to try to re-explain some of it, summarize it again in even simpler terms. An exchange traded, an ETF is an exchange traded fund. Let's start with that. An ETP is an exchange traded product. So an ETF is a type of ETP. There are other types. We won't go into that. It took me a while, honestly, to fully understand it. But in practice, what happens is that a company, an issuer like 21 Shares establishes a fund. That fund buys a lot of Bitcoin in this case, and is therefore owns a lot of Bitcoin. So the value of the fund essentially, because it's a fund that only exists in order to own Bitcoin, the value of the fund changes in relation to the price of Bitcoin. And then why is it a security? Because essentially the fund is broken down into shares. Those shares are parts of that fund, almost like a company that essentially all it does is hold Bitcoin. Those shares are traded as the securities, essentially representing pieces of value of that company or fund. And that's essentially what people buy in, right? It's an attractive product, in a lot of ways, because it's an ability to invest in something, in this case, Bitcoin, there are a lot of other kinds of ETPs, but in this case, Bitcoin, without actually buying Bitcoin. Yeah. That's really the bottom line. And specifically, by the way, please keep me honest here, but specifically, when it comes to Bitcoin, which is still a very volatile asset where there are questions about custody, there are hacks, etc., and there's a, you know, the kind of purest way to own it is through self-custody, then specifically because of all of these risks associated with Bitcoin, it particularly provides an added level of safety. It was basically a safer way, less exposed way to get exposed, benefit from the, or, you know, benefit or from the increasing price of Bitcoin over time. Was that a fair, very, very simple minded way to explain it?
Very fair. I think the two themes of why an ETF or ETP structure is important here is really twofold. One, as you said, it's among the safest ways to invest in crypto as an asset class. Put aside Bitcoin, really any crypto asset, it's among the safest ways. And why is that? It's because it's regulated. It's because that, the fund itself, the securities itself are subject to immense, regulatory requirements when it comes to custody, when it comes to auditing, when it comes to compliance, you name it, and supervision. I think secondly, it's also beneficial because in many ways, it's the most cost-effective way to invest in the asset class. You know, if you were to go onto a centralized exchange, you'd pay transaction fees, you'd pay all types of fees. If you were investing in ETF, you still pay, commissions, you still pay other fees, but in many ways, those fees are actually less than you would pay in other contexts. And so for retail investors, you're essentially getting an institutional investor type product, meaning you're getting institutional security, you're getting institutional custody, you're getting bankruptcy protection, you name it, at a much lower price, really at a retail price. And that's what's interesting about it. And so, as you scale these products, they actually become cheaper, with a very, very, very low management fee, which we've shown in Europe can be really an attractive product.
Yeah. And so, it was important for me to go over this because, again, at this point, I don't think there's anyone in the crypto industry who would tell you, that they don't think, and, it's really important. It's really would be really good for the industry, et cetera, if a Bitcoin ETF would be approved. But I don't think necessarily everyone really goes into in depth into why would it be so valuable. So let me ask you, in addition to the, what you said, it's a less costly way of becoming exposed to Bitcoin and yet get a lot of institutional protections and kind of management. Are there other things that we should keep in mind for why it's good for the industry? I mean, let's think for a second, how would it affect the general volume of Bitcoin trading?
It does. Yeah, I think it's so beneficial. So I think of our industry as really many different layers, but I like to think of it as crypto as an asset class. So people investing in the tokens that are native to various protocols because they want some return on their investment. I also view crypto as really, really what's the underlying technology? What are the other use cases? But I think when you pull both of them together, I think an ETF has immense benefits. I think that ETFs will, crypto-backed ETFs will essentially bring lower prices to crypto transactions. And I think exactly what you said, Chen, that really comes down to volume. I think that there will be increased volume. I think there'll be increased demand for the asset class simply because there's increased access. I mean, think of millions of people in their brokerage accounts. I mean, I think the number I saw is that there are 30 trillion assets under management for like retail in the US, something like that, some massive number. I'm not saying everybody within that pool would access ETFs, but you basically are increasing access. I also think, quite frankly, it could be very good for DeFi. I mean, you think about, put aside Bitcoin, but you think about other tokens that eventually could be incorporated into an ETF. You look at our product suite. We have almost 40 products. They're incorporating really almost all the top 50 tokens that exist in crypto. Crypto ETPs are providing immense benefits for some of the altcoins as well, for which we're one of the leaders. So I think DeFi benefits from a volume perspective. DeFi liquidity has gone down in crypto winter. I think this could help bring it back up. I think this could help lending rates in DeFi. I think this can help, help execution, which is struggling right now. So, people think of crypto ETFs and ETPs as, this product that just benefits institutional investors. I actually think it benefits more than just the asset class. I think it benefits the underlying technology too.
Yeah, ultimately, first of all, everything you say makes total sense. I agree 100%. And I think maybe again, if I put my simple mind to it, I think maybe kind of a simple way of thinking about it is the ETF industry is a multi-trillion dollar industry. And when I say multi-trillion, I mean the high multi-trillion. I don't have the number in front of me. I totally should have Googled it before we started the conversation. But, you know, I think at some point I saw numbers that are like in the tens of trillions sometimes of like how much money is in the global ETF industry. And essentially that's money that investors put into relatively low risk products. Instead of putting that into non-crypto products, a lot of that money could go into crypto. Now, something that you actually told me, you helped me understand it, but essentially when you run an ETF fund, right, you have to at the end of every day, at the end of every week, you would know better than me, you know, the fund has to be rebalanced, meaning that it needs to buy and sell, depending on how many people bought and sell shares of the ETF, right? It needs to buy and sell the asset, in this case, Bitcoin, into its, you know, custodial accounts. And that's just a lot of trading. If you're thinking even of like a small percent of that global trillions of dollars ETF industry, that would become a crypto activity.
Yeah. You're totally right. The fund has to rebalance on a pretty regular basis their net asset value, their NAV, to ensure that it's tracking the price of the underlying asset. Those are really more for physically backed funds. And so, no, you're totally right. And volume would be increased because there'd be a lot more activity. And you got to think the price of the underlying asset will increase. If there's more volume, if there's more demand, the price of that value. Again, not giving investment advice, but that's what a lot of experts on the business side are predicting.
Right. And again, so you know, I know it's a bit silly because, again, it's an axiom that Bitcoin ETF and other crypto ETFs would be good for the industry. But I think it's always good to not take anything for granted. Right. Let's kind of dive even deeper a little bit and think about the current filing, okay? And by the way, there are a lot of things that we won't be able to cover today, which are fascinating. I personally recommend to anyone who cares about crypto to read through the filings. They're all public. Also, if you for advanced people, if you want to read through the SIBO rulebook, that's a bit of a more challenging, that's a bit of a more challenging task. Really hard to find that one particular section. I don't remember the number at this point, but, and also the Securities and Exchange Act, which is the other piece here, right? The 19B. For exemption comes from the Securities and Exchange Act. But I do recommend people to check it out. It's really interesting. So we're not going to be able to touch all of this. There are really interesting pieces in the filings to do, for example, with how the prices of Bitcoin are decided. Different filings have different methodologies, but it's really interesting because it's fundamental to what the industry would look like in the future. But let me kind of jump into your current filing. This current filing really is very similar to the BlackRock filing that got a lot of headlines, right? And essentially, it tries to take a step further from former filings in order to create more assurances that in the case that there is market manipulation, the SEC should be able to investigate and look for whoever was involved by including a proposed shared surveillance agreement between SIBO and Coinbase. So instead of like trying to explain it all myself, can we for a second maybe talk about the evolution of Bitcoin ETF applications? Yeah. Like, and then of course, most importantly, you know, what's different in former ones and what's new here? Why do you essentially people believe this has a higher chance of getting the SEC's approval?
It's a really good question. I believe the Winklevoss twins in Gemini were the first to file. Maybe you could correct me if I'm wrong. I think they were the first to file for a Bitcoin ETF, maybe back in 2013. So a long time ago, over 10 years ago. You look back at their application, it's not active anymore, but they actually had a surveillance sharing agreement with BATS, which now is bought by SIBO. So you know, the idea of a surveillance sharing agreement is not new. If you look at the Bitcoin futures industry and CME, they already have that in place. I think that's what got the SEC comfortable, that that was a, you know, a sufficiently surveilled market, so to speak. They use different language, but essentially that's what they mean, is that a healthy market is a market that's subject to surveillance. You know, I think the evolution since then is there have been a lot of issuers who have pitched, you know, various structures. I think, you know, is a surveillance sharing agreement, you know, the silver bullet now with the SEC? I don't know. I think that, you know, the data in our application, we made clear that, you know, the Bitcoin futures market and the Bitcoin spot market, you know, are sufficiently similar. So therefore, if the SEC is comfortable that the futures market is safe, we believe that also applies to the spot market, because spot prices influence future prices. So if futures prices are okay, why wouldn't the underlying influencer prices not be okay? But I guess really simply, you know, in our application, we talk about a shared surveillance agreement. I think there'll be more to come on that front. We actually also introduce a new concept in this iteration, which is that, you know, if you look at all the other centralized crypto players that have sought bankruptcy protection, that have become insolvent, that have been engaged in massive frauds under criminal investigation, you name it. You know, if a regulated Bitcoin or crypto ETF had been around at that time, think of how many investors and how much money they would have saved. And that was really one of the key arguments we changed and we added in. And it wasn't to say, hey, somebody messed up. No, it's not about that. It's say, hey, all right, look at what could have happened in the past if this was in place, a regulated product, and how investors could have benefited. And so, you know, there are a lot of things that are different in our application. It remains to be seen what quite frankly, will convince the SEC.
So that, you know, that is a really good point. And I think the truth is no one knows exactly what will happen. A couple of points I want to highlight in what you're saying. First of all, I remember reading that, and it was such a strong argument, because, you know, the reason SECs have been rejected is, you know, at least on the face of it, to protect investors. In practice, there are people who argue that by not approving an ETF and not being willing to take some risk, you know, there's an abdication of protection of investors. I want to, you know, kind of very briefly, other things that are mentioned in the filing that are really interesting. There's a lot of very complex calculations using all kinds of models. I learned a lot of new words like co-kurtosis, which is essentially a mathematical way of comparing, you know, shifts in value across multiple, venues at the same time. So essentially, part of the argument, a big part of the finding, is really showing how Bitcoin has become less volatile over the
exactly,
years.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly only, right.
And then not only less volatile, but when there is volatility, then that's where the co-kurtosis comes in. When there is volatility, the volatility is unified across the entire market, which is very important, because prices changes, it's fine. If they change in a way that is different, and then the price that the ultimately the investors in Bitcoin through the ETF, you know, get affected by is lower than, is different than, you know, or doesn't represent what's actually going on in the market. That's a concern for potentially manipulative behavior, et cetera. Yeah. I do want to mention that earlier, like I remember in 2018, 2019, a big part of the concern on the, there were basically two concerns that were raised in the SEC's rejection documents, which are the responses to each filing. One of them was to do with market concerns about market manipulation and the absence of shared surveillance agreements. And we'll focus on that. But custody used to actually be a really big problem. Yeah. It used to be very central. And it's no longer really mentioned anymore, which people don't talk about, but it does speak dramatically to the evolution of the industry. You know, like, we were at a time where regulators didn't believe that custody of crypto assets is safe. That's no longer the case. Yeah. So again, we need to also kind of sometimes focus on the good stuff, right?
Yeah. No, you're totally right. And same with market makers too. I mean, there's a lot more institutional players, TradFi players, that are willing to make a market in various crypto tokens. And custody is such an interesting industry. I mean, the rates for custody now are it is getting so tight. I mean, it's just a really interesting market, to your point. And you have, you know, you look at the New York DFS Mild Office. I mean, they were the first to license essentially crypto custodians as limited purpose trust companies. These are really non-depository banks, basically, who really can't lend out assets, but they have other fiduciary obligations and have other powers and are subject to the full New York banking law. And so you have, you know, new regulatory frameworks that came into effect in 2015 with the BitLicense. You've got a real maturity and evolution in the market, a lot more talent from TradFi coming into crypto, which is making these companies more mature, more compliant, you name it. It's a different industry now than it was 3 years ago.
Yeah, no, it's a really good point. And by the way, you know, I warned everyone that this might be a longer episode than usual because it's such a fascinating topic. I do want to be aware of the fact that it's now, for me, it's almost 1 a.m. So I have no meetings coming after this. I know you might. Well, I'll ask for a second if you're going to have to jump off in 10 minutes because that would affect some of my coming.
I'll take as long as you need to go. I can go as long as you need to go. Okay. As long as you can stay awake. That's what's important.
I mean, I'll do my best not to keep you here for hours and hours, but you know, I just wanted to know how concise I have to be. So, okay. As you know, Solidus is a surveillance, crypto market surveillance firm. You know, Citigroup named us category definer for crypto market surveillance. But, you know, I'm saying this to say that the surveillance piece has always been fascinating to us. In a way, one of the reasons when we founded the company, we wanted to focus on market manipulation was because we saw that the SEC is repeatedly rejecting these applications, even though there were ways that, you know, the same concerns were resolved in the eyes of the SEC in traditional finance. So, you know, for us, that was another example that there's something unique about how crypto markets can be manipulated. And please forgive me for taking a minute. It is important for me to say how I see the rejections, because my perspective is a little different, I think, than many in the market. I actually think that, well, there is a political question around, you know, is it too much overreach, not more overreach, obligation of responsibility, no obligation of responsibility. I actually find when I read through the through the rejections, that there's an important point the SEC is making there about the fundamental infrastructural difference with crypto markets. And that is really what the problem here is that Bitcoin or digital assets, crypto, is really the first example of a non-physical asset. I mean, not like gold or copper, right? That is not centralized to any one exchange. So, you know, that means that there are a lot of different places, honestly, an infinite amount of places. Some of them are off-chain in centralized exchanges. Some of them are on-chain in decentralized exchanges, where theoretically, at least, the price could be affected. And really, the SEC is saying, okay, it's great. The ETF will be traded in a fully regulated, surveilled way on SIBO or NYSE. That won't be manipulated. Okay, we can also look at the futures market, like you said earlier, the spot, the Bitcoin futures ETF market on CME. That's another fully regulated market. It's quite large and it's considered very healthy. And there is a shared surveillance agreement already as part of an organization called the Intermarket Surveillance Group between CBO and CME and many other exchanges. So in that sense, they're under a shared surveillance agreement. But, you know, what about the, you know, and what about the million other places where Bitcoin is traded? What about the fact that anyone can open a centralized Bitcoin exchange? It does, without any regulation, somewhere around the world, anyone can open hundreds of wallets, potentially trade them in ways that would be very hard to detect, and bottom line, it's a decentralized asset that's traded in a permissionless, fully open ecosystem. And therefore, they are basically saying, I want to understand, how do I know that if there was manipulation, I will find out about it. And second of all, I'll be able to investigate it. Now, let me ask you for a second. Can we explain what a shared surveillance agreement even is? Because the truth is that it's not exactly about surveillance. It's more of an information sharing agreement. So may I ask you for a second to explain?
That's exactly right. Yeah, no, I mean, it depends what's in the SSA, but you're right. It's information sharing. And, you know, obviously there's a technical component to it, but it's really making sure that you know, where activities happening at one market participant, another market participant can really get insights into that. What's interesting about Bitcoin and crypto is that it's the only asset class where you can track activity really open source. And so you're right. Like if you're trading gold, you're trading some other commodity, corn, you name it, soy, like it's really hard to track activity.
I can go my neighbor physically and no one would know.
You could go to OTC. Exactly. You could trade it. You could go across the road, trade your bushel of corn for X amount of fiat dollars, and nobody would ever know it happened. That's impossible in crypto. Obviously there are mixers, there are privacy mechanisms that you can do, but generally speaking, most of the time people can use amazing tools like Solidus's and other providers to figure out what is going on. And so you're right. Its value is driven by the fact that it's decentralized. I mean, that's what interests people. I think that from a market manipulation perspective, there's different factors at play than maybe other commodities. That's what makes this whole shared surveillance agreement question really interesting.
Yeah. It's funny because let me again go back to my simple mind and try to explain how I understand shared surveillance agreement in practice, what it means. And based on the definition, there's a term that's in all of the filings and later in the rejections. The term is there needs to be an information sharing agreement with all of the hallmarks of a shared surveillance agreement. The hallmarks of a shared surveillance agreement in practice are basically that all of the exchanges where either the derivative asset, right, the ETF, or the original asset are traded, essentially all of the exchanges where the price might be affected by trading have to be committed contractually to be ready to share trading, clearing, and personal information about traders in the case that there is some sort of regulatory investigation to do with any one of the other members. So essentially, let's say theoretically, the SEC goes to SIBO and tells it, we believe there was market manipulation in the futures market and that affected the price of Bitcoin. CME needs to be ready to share that information, to share information about the incidents with SIBO and with the regulator. So it's really about readiness to share information in the case that there is an investigation, more than anything. So it's not active surveillance. Active surveillance, for us, when we talk about surveillance, we're thinking about in real time, looking at trades, looking at transactions, cross on and off chain, which is part of any sort of crypto native risk monitoring solution, and being able to understand exactly how that happens. So to me, it's a very important distinction, and I wanted to make it. But I do want to kind of respond to what you said there, because it's true that Bitcoin is a decentralized asset and it's on the blockchain. Something that we forget sometimes as an industry is that while the assets are decentralized, Bitcoin is decentralized, a lot of the activity, 80, 90% of the activity most of the time is actually centralized. It happens centralized order books. And those centralized order books are not visible from the blockchain. Sure. They're essentially black boxes for anyone, and that's really the part where the shared surveillance agreements come into place.
It makes perfect sense, because a lot of exchanges are using omnibus accounts to execute transactions. So you're right, in many ways you need their internal data to really get a sense of who's doing what. And it's the same way, when you look at the AML space, the anti-money laundering space, with the travel rule, it's the same thing. Transferring customer information across market participants has been in place for 20 years. It hasn't really applied to crypto until more recently, but that concept at other traditional financial institutions has been around since the 90s. So you're totally right.
Yeah. No, true. And by the way, I sometimes get flack for saying this sort of stuff. And I do agree, by the way, I agree that in a lot of ways, Bitcoin is less manipulable than traditional assets. But I do think there's it's an interesting question about this access to information. So getting towards the end of this ETF topic, although to be honest with you, I could have asked a million more questions. But, the Jewish Talmud says that prophecy has been given to the fools. And I kind of hate being asked in interviews and stuff like that. Will this one be approved? Will it not? But then again, everyone loves predictions. So I'm curious to ask you, do you think it will be approved? Obviously no one knows for sure, but any thoughts on the likelihood or less thereof or lack thereof?
It's a really good question. I think there will be a spot Bitcoin ETF in the future. And the real question is, when will it be? This round will take longer. I'm cautiously optimistic. I am. I think that there is momentum now. I think that the exchanges have demonstrated in their rule filings that they've done enough to essentially ensure the SEC's main concern, market manipulation, has been taken care of by the shared surveillance agreement. So I think there is more than enough of a case made to approve it. Well, the question is, will the SEC approve it?
Right.
I don't know. I hope so. I think it's time. I think it's appropriate. I think that the market wants it. Politically, people want it. It's just a question of whether they're going to do it or not. And also, you know, there's also litigation going on right now with Grayscale. And who knows what could happen, you know, at the court level, similar to what happened at Ripple. So, you know, there's a lot of factors at play. I think something will happen. It will. It's inevitable. It's just a question of when.
I agree completely. And you're so right about the litigation going on. We've seen that, you know, it isn't always predictable, as with the XRP Ripple case. I will say that from my vantage point, I hope that an ETF will be approved as soon as possible. I do. I actually think, though, that the most constructive way to think about the ETF discussion is really about this fundamental infrastructural question, because regardless of whether a Bitcoin spot ETF would be approved or not, we need to constantly be minded of the market integrity challenge, this reality of a market where the assets are decentralized and therefore can be traded anywhere, but in practice they're traded both on-chain where there is transparency, off-chain where there isn't transparency. And you know, at the end of the day, market integrity, preventing market manipulation, a big part of it is not even about whether, you know, it's not even about whether there is market manipulation. It's about how do you provide the confidence that there isn't. That's, you know, the business that we're in. And obviously, you know, you guys are in other directions. But, you know, you guys, you know, you have approved Bitcoin ETPs and, you know, crypto ETPs in Europe. So you also bring this global perspective, which I think is also really important, because it is something to be said that it has been approved in other places. It hasn't been approved in the US. I'm curious for your thoughts on that. I do want to say that I always remind myself that when people say that, you know, it's very hard to compare the United American capital markets to capital markets anywhere in the world. More than 60% of the world's capital is you know, being, you know, traded in in US capital markets, which means that if there is an issue that happens here, creates this instability, et cetera, it's going to have massive ramifications. So I give a bit of the benefit of that to the SEC. But can you tell us a little bit about the experience of getting these approved abroad in Europe, or any kind of comparative thoughts?
Yeah, we've been doing this in Europe for years now. Our ETPs are available in nearly every country in the EEA, so it's not just the EU. We issue most of our ETPs are physically backed, and so our ETPs really trade like debt, like non-interest-bearing debt instruments, and we hold collateral, which is the crypto, on behalf of investors in really a debt type arrangement. And there's many reasons for that in Europe. It's a very popular product there. And there's reasons why we're not doing a fund over there compared to a fund in the US. But, you know, we have proven in Europe to be successful of operating these exchange traded products that are physically backed by many different crypto assets. And, you know, you look at the European capital markets, they do operate differently because each European state has different rules and there are cross-listing requirements, prospectus requirements, and we comply with all of them. But I will say, you know, Europe has been open to the idea of these products, I would say, earlier than some other capital markets, including the United States. And so, you know, in Switzerland, you know, we launched our first product almost 5 years ago. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's a long time ago to be active. And so, you know, we've cut our chops over there. We've fine-tuned operationally everything over there. That you look at some of the issuers in the US that have been doing futures products. A futures product is not a crypto product. It's a futures product. It's very different. It operates very differently. And so, you know, you asked about Europe and Canada and some other jurisdictions. We're not active in Canada, but we are in Europe, the Middle East, and some parts of Asia. You know, I think we've proven that our products can operate in a safe manner that investors can expect reliability. And, you know, we've been there in the bull market and the bear market, and we're still here. So I think there's a lot of lessons that can be learned from a business and regulatory perspective from some of those other jurisdictions.
And thank you for sharing those lessons with us. It's fascinating. No, really, it is. It's fascinating. And there is a tendency in the United States to sometimes, you know, as the most important economy in the world, you sometimes tend to be a little centered on what's going on here and forget that there's a lot of really important markets elsewhere. So I think it's a really important point. So we are getting towards the end of our time, even though honestly I could have done this for a very long time. But let's do, if it's okay with you, a bit of a speedish finishing round. So about yours and 21 Shares' perspective. So looking forward, and we already talked about whether an ETF would be approved or not. No one can put a date on it. I think you summarized it as being cautiously optimistic and that it is going to happen. It's just a question of when. So it doesn't have to be about an ETF. I'm curious in general. Where do you see the market? So, you know, speedish round, do with it whatever you'd like. You know, it can be one sentence, it could be a few, it can be more. So starting with, what is your outlook? I mean, where do you see the market going in the next 6 to 12 months? A lot of people are talking about coming out of the bear market, but a lot of people in crypto also tend to be, very, very optimistic. So, will we see more adoption? Any thoughts, on progress and the slight progress in regulation in the US recently, or any thoughts about the industry in the next 6 to 12 months?
Yeah, my short and sweet answer is regulatory clarity is coming. I really believe that. I think that there, and I talked about the US, look at the US, like there has been regulatory clarity over the past 10 years. I mean, banking regulators are allowing money transmitter licenses. FinCEN is allowing MSB registrations for crypto operators. There is clarity. It is coming. Court cases are happening. So that, you know, some of the court cases I don't like, some of the other ones I do like. So regulatory clarity will drive confidence, will drive adoption. I believe in that. Blockchain itself is getting more efficient. VC obviously has been not as robust in the crypto space. I think that will come back. But I think ultimately crypto winter, I think has been good for weeding out the strong dedicated players from those that are not. Those like Solidus, 21 Shares, have been building during this time period. And we have. We've been building. We've been all in, not pulling back at all. And to us, that's really important to just show that we still have, supreme, confidence that this industry really does matter. And it's interesting. My wife is in crypto. My in-laws, I was talking to them. My mother-in-law told me, "We don't need crypto." Those were her words. And it meant a lot. I was like, it wasn't that the world doesn't need it. It was that they don't need it, which was fine. But I believe the world does need it. And this has increased my conviction rate for sure.
Interesting. No, yeah, I think it's a good point. And it's a fair way to say it. Like, I don't need it versus the world. Uh-huh. I mean, at the end of the day, there's so many people who are unbanked. There are so many people who are not, benefiting from financial growth the way it benefits kind of the broader economy, because they don't have access to sophisticated or effective financial instruments, and crypto can provide a lot of answers to all of that. So good answer. You didn't give me a clear-cut answer on yes or no to are we getting out of the bull market, but I'm not gonna push.
I don't know. You gotta talk to our research team and our data team. I think they're cautiously optimistic. I'm just a measly crypto lawyer. What do I know? But no, I feel like we're going to get out of something. I do think so. Will it be the bull market of before? No, it's not going to be. And I think one of our big thesis statements is that technology is a legitimate and regulatory compliant intermediary. So I think eventually, philosophically, the more that our country, the more that the world comes around to that view, that there's really a changing of a guard when it comes to intermediaries. That's what I think is interesting. So I'm bullish on that thesis statement.
I love it. Technology as a effective, safe, and regulatory compliant, usherer of this new asset class and all the opportunities it brings. Continuing with our speed round quickly, you've mentioned that you've been building a lot, which you know is really, you know, I agree with you completely. This was, you know, it was a it's a tough time, the bear market, but it's a good time to build. Any exciting news to expect from you, from 21 shares in the next few months? Anything? And it's also okay to say
There's so much. We're working on so much. There's going to be a lot. I just would say stay tuned. We're working on a lot.
Okay. Stay tuned. You heard it from Andrew. And finally, you did actually, I think, just throughout the conversation, naturally, you know, provide a lot of really, really helpful best practices for how to manage teams, how to assimilate legal strategy into business strategy and a lot of other stuff. But if I asked you to try and think, you know, is there any other best practice? Is there any other tip? What are you going to be focused on in the next 6 months that you want to share with our audience? And keep in mind, our audience is ultimately a lot of crypto risk, compliance, regulatory, and legal professionals. So I want to believe that they find this helpful. Anything you'd like to mention as we finish?
Yeah, I think I would close by, you know, at least at our company, we're building really a best-in-class crypto legal and compliance department. And so what does that mean? That means we know the technology as well as the tech team does. And we have a fundamental expertise in various areas of the law. When you pull those together, you build really a best-in-class in-house risk, legal, compliance, whatever you want to call it. You build a really exceptional protector for the company and facilitator for new business. So that in everything I think about, that's what we always push. So I'll conclude with that.
Well, I think there can't be any a better conclusion than that. Andrew, thank you so much for taking the time, for staying over the time we put on the calendar, and for burying my sometimes slightly convoluted questions. but I really enjoyed it. I learned like anytime I do when I speak with you, and I hope the listeners have learned as well. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure. And I hope you can get some sleep tonight in Hong Kong. That's all I'll say. Thank you, Ken. It was a pleasure.
Flying back to New York tomorrow. So I'll see you in person. Thank you.